One. Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Let's Get Real with Ruben Torres on blogtalkradio.com. Tonight we have an exciting show, just like we do every week. But tonight we have a special guest, Governor Whitman from the great state of New Jersey, who is my favorite governor in New Jersey so far during my time in New Jersey. She did a great job, and she's doing a great job, and we'll learn a lot more of what she's doing today. Before we proceed ahead, we have a full agenda tonight. Besides, Governor Whitman will be calling in a couple of minutes, probably right at 10 after 6. But before we go on, we'll have my usual monologue regarding the whole situation with the economy. This past week, we had the second largest mortgage holder, IndyMac.
Hello.
Good evening. Yes.
Hi, it's Christy Whitman.
Governor Whitman, how are you?
I am very well.
Okay, it's an honor to have you. I wanted to introduce you, but basically at this moment we'll proceed ahead.
Okay.
It's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the Let's Get Real with Ruben Torres program, and a lot of my listeners were very excited to know that you were appearing tonight.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you. It's good to talk to you.
Great. So many things are happening around the globe, and I know you've been traveling quite a bit. As a matter of fact, your trip to China.
Right.
Just recently had in regards to basically the what the Whitman Strategy Group is doing on a global basis and also in the United States. Can you give us an overview of how was it founded and where is it now and where is it going?
Sure. Well, I founded it when I left the Environmental Protection Agency. It's with four partners. I've got four partners, two in Washington and two here in New Jersey. And what we do is we have taken our expertise. Everybody who's with me was with me when I was governor, and then mm-hmm. down in Washington. And we work with companies around the world and here in New Jersey and around the country to show them how they can do a better job with their environment and still make money, how to improve their environmental profile and make money and make it work for everybody. So it's fun to be able to make some money, as we do, helping
mm-hmm.
people do the right thing.
Now, when was it? It was founded for my listeners.
2003, probably. I left the administration. Well, no, 2004, because I left the administration in 2003, and I founded it toward the end of that 2003, beginning of 2004. And so, as I say, the project in China was a big fund that we are going to be advising that is going to do green investment both in China and in the United States, as long as it can be a technology that might be used in China to help them improve their environment,
right,
which, as you know, has an impact on us. Because today,
sure does.
a great amount of the particulate matter that you find on the west coast of the United States comes from the Pacific Rim, so we need to care what they're doing.
Definitely. Well, I was in China last year, and I noticed in cities like Xi'an City and in northwest China, there's still a lot of these coal factories, and you can feel and you can see the pollution all over. I mean, especially if you go to the Great Wall, it's very hard to breathe.
Well, the in Beijing, the air quality, breathing the air in Beijing is the equivalent
mm-hmm.
of two packs of cigarettes a day. And they're bringing on a new coal-fired power plant a week. And,
right,
you know, Mother Nature has never cared about geopolitical boundaries, so a lot of what happens there ends up in other parts of the world, and we're the recipients of some of it as well.
Right, especially with the enormous growth of economic boom that is happening in mainland China, throughout the whole region of China, is just booming. Construction and automobiles. I mean, there's over, 300 million middle-class Chinese. So that they're buying automobiles. They're basically they're going to be growing. So I think projects like the projects that you're working on will be a huge success.
Well, we certainly hope so. It's one of those things where we think we can help them see how they can make a difference and still make it economical. And we try to do the same thing here, too, with companies. The important thing is to understand that we don't live in one of those worlds where it's either or. You either have a clean and green environment or a healthy, thriving economy. We can and we must have both. We need both things, and we can't allow ourselves to get backed into the corner of saying, well, it's one or the other. Somebody has to lose if somebody else is going to win. That's not what it's all about.
Right. Now, China is not. China has not signed on to the Kyoto Protocol, which is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. How is that impacting convincing the Chinese to that this is a critical situation? I mean, the climate that's been impacted is getting impacted by the enormous amount of pollution that is surrounding all of China.
Well, it's hard for us in the United States to persuade them along those lines at all because we aren't doing anything and from a mandatory perspective. You know, I agree with the president in that the Kyoto Protocol is not the way to go because it has to include China and India, and it didn't.
Right.
And it probably never will. But to be effective, it must. But if we're going to put any real pressure on any of these developing countries, and India is starting to develop as quickly. It's not obviously as big, but it's developing very quickly and is unfortunately not as clean as we'd like it. We need to take some steps ourselves, and I think we will. We have two presidential candidates, both of whom recognize the issue of climate change as being a serious one, if for no other reason than greenhouse gases are pollutants, and that's bad for us and our air quality, for us to breathe. So they will be taking some action, and once we've done that, some mandatory action. We've done a lot on a voluntary basis, but a lot of people don't count that. Once we've taken some mandatory action, it'll be a lot easier to bring along some of these other countries.
Governor Whitman, we have a listener. They want to jump right in and ask you a question.
Sure.
Yes, can you state your name and your question?
Hi, my name is Louis. I'm from Brooklyn. Just wondering, Miss Whitman.
Yeah.
Did you lie about the air quality in 9/11?
Oh, Louis, thank you for asking that question. Actually, I'm delighted to be able to answer it because we never lied. The agency never lied, and we never withheld information. The problem we always had, and that I think the citizens have had in understanding this, is there were two messages to get out. One was about the air quality of those workers working on the pile in Ground Zero, and the other was for ambient air quality for people residing in downtown Manhattan in the general area. And there was a difference in that air quality because working on the pile were subject to releases that were very problematic, and we were constantly saying they should wear respirators. We, in fact, provided as many as we had, and the rest of the federal government, state government did it as well. But we had websites up. We had messages going out to people to let them compare what we were seeing, the readings we were getting, and we never held back any of the information. And nothing that we saw, that our scientists saw, and everything that I said was based on what the scientists said was accurate to say, was that there was we didn't see any reason to believe that there were long-term damage from ambient air quality in downtown Manhattan in general. People on the pile, rescue workers, absolutely they needed to take precautions. But for the general public, it wasn't the same level of concern. And I haven't seen a study since then, whether it's Mount Sinai or any of the others, that says that, in fact, we were wrong at that. Although the agency is very concerned and is part of the ongoing study to see, to track, to see if there was anything wrong with what was said at any point in time. But so far, no. And the big issue is, why didn't people wear respirators and why didn't we make them wear respirators? And
I mean, if I could interrupt real quick, the White House did do a lot of editing to the EPA's report that said that there was a danger.
This was reported by ABC.
You're
talking about one press release that the public, one press release that the White House looked at and said we had had in that press release that we thought people ought to use professional cleaners to clean the interior of their homes.
Okay, but how do you explain the 50,000 dead and dying first responders?
Let me interject here. Can we keep it on topic? Did Governor Whitman answer your question?
Well, I don't think Louis believes the answer. I think that's the problem here, it's really too bad because it's become part of the culture that somehow we lied in this. And the agency, I have to tell you, if nothing else, you think that the men and women, the professionals who work at the Environmental Protection Agency would sit back and allow the administrator to go out and provide misinformation and not say anything when they work down there as well. I mean, their building was within two blocks of Ground Zero, and they were back in that building as fast as any group was allowed back in a building before the residents were allowed back in. They worked down there. There's no way they would have allowed me or anyone else to go out and provide false information. And it's really too bad that this myth of we lied has taken such hold. But part of it is, I understand it, it's because the message didn't get bifurcated the way it needed to, that people heard everything was fine, now they see responders getting sick. We always said the responders were in danger, the responders needed to wear respirators, but the respirators were hot, the respirators clogged, the respirators got in the way of them doing the job that they were impassioned to do to rescue their brothers and sisters. And we have to remember what the times were like, and that's why they didn't wear them. It wasn't they were being irresponsible. It was they had a different mission.
ABC News did show that there was editing going on to your report.
Well, go to CBS, too. Okay, you can say ABC said that there was one press release where the White House had us take something out that was not – it was something that I said immediately. I said I wasn't going
to
fight
them over
that.
Who told the line when it came to the Bush administration?
It was one out of – Let the governor finish
her sentence.
It was one out of – we didn't communicate just by press release. We communicated by – radio, by television, by press release, by going out and speaking to community groups. It was one press release where they took out one line that was not something that was going to put people in danger. And in fact, the thing that they took out was something I said anyway. It was more important to get the rest of the press release out, which provided more information for people. We had a website up within 10 days that synthesized all the information and readings that were being taken by the state, by the city, by the hospitals, and by ourselves to show people exactly what those readings were so they could see day to day, hour to hour by hour, real time. The agency did an extraordinary job, and I'm really proud of the men and women of that agency. And I have to say again, if you think for one second that they would have allowed anyone to provide misinformation there, you don't know that agency or those people very well.
Louis, do you have another question?
I just hope your conscience is clear.
And my son lives down there. Whatever else you think of me, if you think that I would ever put my son in danger, he was in Building 7 on the day. I lost good friends down there. He lives down there now with his wife. He lived down there through it all. I did not ever lie. My conscience is very, very clear.
Well, I'm just saying, you're just lucky the court didn't find you liable.
Obviously, you've made up your mind, and you don't want to hear the actual facts. And there was a reason why the court found us not liable, because we weren't liable because we didn't lie. It's that simple.
Okay. Is that it?
That's pretty much it. Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Louis.
Okay.
Let's move on. We have important things to talk about, which is the environment, the climate change. Where is this going? We've heard you're in favor of nuclear energy.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, currently, France, 87% of French electricity comes from nuclear energy. Why are we not building more nuclear energy plants in the United States?
Back in the 1970s, we got out of the business, and that was after Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and then the China Syndrome. Now, Chernobyl was a plant that never would have been licensed in this country, ever, and neither then nor now. And Three Mile Island was definitely a failure in the reactor, but it was a success story to the, in the degree that everything that was put in place to protect the people working there and the community worked. Nobody was exposed to increased radiation. There have been no health consequences. There were no problems. That was all contained the way it should have. It was a failure no one wanted to have happened, but the part that was designed to protect the public worked. And so, but at that time, the feeling was, well, this is too dicey. We don't want to do any more of it, and we kind of got out of the business. Meanwhile, the rest of the world went ahead, mostly using our technology, and now they're using a great deal of nuclear to provide their power and been doing it safely. We have 20% of our power here in the United States today is nuclear, is from nuclear power, and people don't always recognize that. And what we need to do, if you look at how we're growing and how our economy is growing, it's projected that we will have a 25% increase in demand for electricity by 2030. We've got to figure out how we meet that in a way that gives us constant, affordable power that doesn't trash the environment.
That's very true, but I think it boils down to politics, doesn't it?
A lot of it, a lot of it. And the I co-chair something called Case Energy, Clean and Safe Energy. It's cleansafeenergy.org. And I co-chair that with Dr. Patrick Moore, who was one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, a very strong environmental organization. And we both feel that the important thing here is to get information out to the public about the facts on nuclear, so they can make informed decisions and decide, is this the right thing for them or not?
Now, the other big news that happened this week is the whole thing with the president moving for offshore drilling, which is something that I, again, on my radio show every week during my monologue, I'm constantly saying, why is certain individuals in Congress, in the Senate, against drilling?
Well,
we have enough.
That if there's a disaster, what's going to happen if there's a leak? And that's an understandable concern. But the other side of it is, as I'm sure you've been pointing out, is you have to look at what's been happening recently. We have, if you look at the Gulf of Mexico, we've been extracting a lot of oil from there and been doing it very well. And the industry has learned a lot. There have been spills. There's no question about it. But technology has advanced. The environmentalists sometimes don't want to take credit for what they've done. And the pressure they've put on government and the pressure they put on industry has resulted in some great strides forward. So we can't keep saying no to everything. That's our problem in this country. We're very good at saying no. You know, this is too dangerous. This might cost too much. No, no, no. And you want to say, look, if we don't want to have to live with rolling brownouts or blackouts, we've got to figure out how we're going to meet our energy demands. And yes, we want more conservation. Yes, we want more renewable power. All those things are good. But they're not going to get us to where we need to be by 2030. And it's not the kind of thing that you can wake up one day and say, we need more power, and expect to get it on the next day. It takes years to bring these things online.
I mean, we haven't built a refinery in about 30 years in this country when we have the technology to build a refinery. Now, some have said that it's too costly to build a refinery in the United States. Do you agree?
Well, if it's too costly to build, it's going to cost money, yes. But if it's too costly to build a refinery, it's too costly to build nuclear, it's too costly to for the environment and dollar-wise to do coal, how are we going to meet our energy demands? Unfortunately, the raw truth of the matter is it's going to cost us more in the future. Energy will cost more, however we do it. Believe me, wind power costs a lot of money and takes up a lot of land. Solar power costs a lot of money, takes up a lot of land. Everything has its drawbacks and trade-offs. What we've got to do is find the right mix that will ensure that we don't have a huge spike in cost of energy, but that recognizes that we've got to start making these decisions now. We've got to have the intelligent conversation. We've got to ask our leading officials, our elected officials, what are they going to do to meet our energy needs? They can't just keep saying no, no, no to everything.
Right, because right now the American people are hurting. I mean, the enormous amount of money that they're spending on fuel. And we have another caller. Yes, can you state your name and your question?
Yeah, hello?
Hello.
Am I on here? Christine Todd Whitman?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Vin from New York, and I just wanted to know, Ms. Whitman, why did you say that the air was clean to breathe after 9/11 when you knew that it wasn't, and it's been proven that all those people knew that it wasn't good air, and all the first responders sick from.
Why do I think there's a pattern here, Vince? Look.
I think Governor Whitman has actually stated already what the facts were. Do you have another question?
Yeah, I mean, how are you going to like it when you're in jail with all the rest of the criminals that are behind 9/11? And, you know, the people know that you're part of the cover-up because it's pretty clear that you don't care about anybody except, your bank account.
Okay, I
bank account had
Vince, I'm gonna have to hang you up. We gotta have respect here, okay?
I go to
hell. Okay. Apologize for that, Governor Whitman.
Okay.
Yes. What is your name and your question?
Hi, my name is Dallas, and I just wanted to ask Ms. Whitman, all right, so you stated that you did not engage any lies regarding the air quality at Ground Zero following 9/11. How do you account for the several thousand first responders that worked without masks that are now sick from breathing that air? That doesn't really add up in my head.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, I'm not a scientist, so I'm not a doctor. I can't make the finding. But I would absolutely agree with you that they are getting sick because of the air they breathe. And that's why the message that I gave out every time, and if you watch the CNN, Katie Couric did a special where she actually shows one of the interviews where I did where I said the ambient air quality generally in lower Manhattan is okay, but I was actually holding a respirator and said, but people working on the pile must wear a respirator. It was a bifurcated message. We delivered it every day. I had people from EPA who were down there wearing monitors on the pile, taking real-time readings, who went up to workers and said, you must put on your mask, and were told to get out of the way. It was one of those situations where, unfortunately, the primary responder, the people, when you have a disaster like this, the primary responder is the city, and then it goes to the state and the federal government. EPA did not have the authority to force the responders to wear respirators. It was the Department of Labor who could do that, but they could only do it with the voluntary responders, not any of the responders who were part of a local government or a state or local government who were professional, who were full-time responders. They have no control over them. And so it was the private contractors who actually wore the respirators the most because that was being enforced by OSHA, by that part of the Department of Labor that could do it. EPA provided wash stations for the trucks, wash stations for the workers. We were very concerned about the air quality and what it would do for the workers, but there was a difference between what was happening on that pile and the exposure to the workers on the pile and the ambient air quality in general in lower Manhattan. And that was the issue. I would agree with you. I do believe that the workers are getting sick because of their exposure when they weren't wearing their respirators. And as I explained to the earlier caller, one of the reasons they didn't, and this is, I think, a tragedy because I haven't heard one single one of the politicians who ride this horse talking about what they're going to do to and the money they're going to invest to get respirators that don't clog, that aren't cumbersome, that people will wear in these situations. They didn't wear them not because they were irresponsible. They didn't wear them because they were on a mission. They were trying to get to their brothers and sisters, to the people who had been crushed there. And, you know, they wanted to do the best they could, and they didn't want anything that was getting in their way, and the respirators were getting in their way, they felt, many of them.
Well, I think, Governor Whitman, you have stated very clearly what has transpired. So for any future callers, please, let's stay on topic. We're talking about climate changes, the presidential race, and I think Governor Whitman has actually said everything that she needs to say, if you don't mind, if we can stay on topic. Let's if we can continue. The caller hung up. So, in regards to the situation with the drilling, the president just indicated that he's for offshore drilling. The Democrats are pulling back and saying we cannot go ahead and do that. Are the Democrats responsible to the American people, or
well,
are they not?
I mean, this is a big issue, and as a former governor, I obviously believe that the states have a role to play here because it could very directly impact them. But we need to understand, as we were talking earlier, that there have been big improvements made in technology that will allow us to do some of these things without the same exposure to the environment that we've had in the past. Again, I just point to what's been the Gulf of Mexico, where you've had some very severe storms, and you have some huge rigs 110 miles out in the Gulf drilling and bringing oil in and doing it in a very safe manner. And we need to make sure, of course, that whatever we do is done in the most environmentally protective way that we can. But the real key here is what you're getting at, which is we have to have an energy plan. We have to have a comprehensive energy policy, and Congress has got to take it up and look at it not through the political prism, not what's good for my party
mm-hmm.
or how can I make brownie points out
right.
of this, but say what's good for the public, what's really going to answer these problems and put us in a place where we can meet our increased energy demands and do it in a way that's protective of the environment, but do it in a way that provides people with affordable, reliable power.
Right. I mean, we're looking at I was doing my research of preparing for this program. Brazil, a country that is very self-independent when it comes to energy. I mean, they have the sugar-based cane ethanol system. They also just discovered the largest production of oil in southeastern Brazil. So we have to become independent like some of these countries, such as Brazil.
Well, we do, and the only problem is we're never going to be energy independent. That's a great soundbite for a campaign. But
mm-hmm.
energy is fungible. It moves around. The oil moves around. We'll never be independent totally. We're always going to need some outside sources. The point here is to not have to depend so much on countries that hate us, to find sources
right.
of energy that are not going to demand that we do a lot of import of foreign oil and not getting it from the Middle East necessarily. And that's why I believe nuclear is going to be an important part of that, or should be an important part of that, just the way conservation
right.
and renewables. But we need to be sensible, and we need to get moving now. And unfortunately, we haven't seen the kind of leadership. And I will give the president credit for this. He has sent several bills on energy policy up to the Hill, and they get mired down immediately in the partisan bickering. And,
right.
you know, you just can't get anything moving.
Governor, we have another call. Hopefully this will be a lot different.
Yeah.
Yes, good evening. Can you state your name and your question? Hello?
Oh, maybe we lost.
Yes? Okay, let me see. Hello? Can you state your name and your question?
It's David.
Yes, David.
From Rockville Center, New York.
Good evening.
The Democrats and Harry Reid in particular often say that we as a nation, the U.S., is quote-unquote addicted to oil. And it seems to me that oil has produced quite a bit of good in our country as well as bad. We've been able to industrialize and to become one of the world's superpowers for better or for worse, I think for better. Is it this policy of sort of demonizing oil and sort of demonizing the U.S. as we know it with that, is that something do you think will continue in this presidential election? And what can the Republicans do to push back and fight that concept?
That's a great question.
It's a very good question, and I agree with you. It's been so easy to demonize, as I say. We say no to everything and find fault with everything, and oil has been a very important part of our energy mix. What we need to do is look at how we use oil and gas. Does it make sense with oil now topping $145 a gallon and a barrel and going up from there, talking about $200 at some point this summer even? Does it make sense to use that as widely as we do? Should we really be using oil and gas to heat and cool our buildings, or should we use that primarily for our mobile sources, our fleets, our cars, and our buses, and use things, other things, nuclear and coal, let's say, and the renewables for our buildings, for our heating and cooling? And we need to get more and better at this if we're going to really ensure that we have a balance. There's nothing wrong with oil. It's good. And we have oil resources in this country. There are oil resources in friendly countries. But as I say, oil moves around. It's fungible, so we'll never be totally independent. We just want to be less dependent on people who don't think a lot of us and have the ability to hold back oil and drive prices up or down and play with them, because people are really hurting right now. I mean, if they think it's bad now with the car driving, I'm really afraid of what the consequences are going to be when we get into the winter heating system season. That's going to be a real problem. But oil has been our friend. Oil has been good, and we have shown that we can extract oil and not have it result in disasters every time we move it around. But people have gotten into this habit of looking for what's bad with everything and then saying, well, then if it's at all bad or there's a potential for being bad, we can't do anything with it. And that leaves us in a pretty tough spot if we're going to continue to grow economically, because that demands a lot of energy.
Does that answer your question, David?
That does. And just one quick follow-up question.
Sure.
Most of the people that I talk to are expecting $5 plus this year for a gallon of gas. Do you believe that will be the case as well?
Oh, gosh, the way it's going, I mean, we're here in New Jersey, at least, we're still at $4. That we're averaging 4 because we have the lowest in the region, which is nice. But it could do that. And the concept, I think people look at it just what it means for them and their driving, but it's hitting everything. I mean, it is hitting everything, all the products we get because of the cost of transporting them, air service, rail service, everything is trucks that move things around the country. The increases are hitting at all different places, and then are being filtered down to the consumer in a host of different ways. And that's why we're seeing the price of food go up. We're seeing prices of a whole lot of things go up. And a lot of it traces back to the cost of energy.
David, can you stay on the line? We have another caller.
Sure.
Can you state your name and your name and your question?
Hello?
Yes, can you state your name and your question?
Yes, Brian from Manhattan. And my question to Ms. Whitman is, why did she lie about the air quality in Lower Manhattan and endanger the lives of 50,000 first responders as well as citizens living in Lower Manhattan as the EPA director? Yes, as
Brian,
the EPA.
She has answered that question already.
She has? I didn't hear
she
it. Well, what was her response?
Yeah. Governor, do you want to answer?
We can keep doing this all night, or we can go on to the kinds of things that David's talked about. Look, Brian,
yeah.
I didn't lie about anything. Again, the best I can tell you, if nothing else, my son lived down there at the time. If you think that I would expose him to anything, you're crazy.
No,
nobody at EPA would allow anybody to lie. I don't lie. It's just
You made a statement on the 18th that the air was safe to breathe. It's on the record, Christy. I mean,
yes,
I know.
And if you read the entire statement, you would see that applies to the residents in Lower Manhattan, and there was always a distinction between them and the responders. And I feel very strongly that the responders are being adversely affected by the consequences of not having respirators and not wearing respirators during that time, and I think we ought to take care of them.
Isn't that your responsibility,
right,
Christy, as the EPA director? Wasn't that your responsibility?
My responsibility was to tell them that this was an issue, which we did every single day down on the site.
We know that
okay,
the White House ordered the EPA to lie about the air quality down there.
No, you don't
and
know any such thing.
No, we do know that, Christy. We,
okay,
it's
Brian.
On the record. It's on the record,
Brian.
And you will be held accountable for your crimes. You're guilty of manslaughter, Christy. You're guilty
Brian.
Of manslaughter.
Brian.
And
okay,
you
Brian.
Should be held accountable.
Okay. Ruben, we've
okay,
really got to – can you do a little
yeah.
screening just because, I mean, I
yeah.
think, it sounds
yeah.
like they're all in the same place because I can hear people in the background giving
okay.
stuff. And it's fine. I understand people being – upset about this, but I've answered the question. It's been asked and answered.
That's right.
If we can't
that's
come
it.
On
no
other
more,
things, then
no problem. We will not. Okay, David. Is there you have another question for Governor Whitman?
No, just one last thing. I read an article recently. It was in the New York Times, as a matter of fact. It was about this whole air quality thing and Ground Zero. And from what I understand, there really hasn't been this huge surge of people that had problems that were medically identifiable. So I'm not
I mean,
sure
that's,
where...
That's the key there, David. For the people who worked on the pile, yes, they are getting sick. There's just no question about it. But there hasn't been any study that's been done, whether it's been done by Mount Sinai, which has done a lot of follow-up studies, or any organization that said that the residents in Lower Manhattan are getting sick because of the air they breathe because of 9/11. There's been no study that says that. There's been no proof to that. There's been people believe it. They want to believe it. They're concerned. They feel that this is an issue, but it hasn't been proven. And that's the frustrating thing here, that you keep
right.
to say to people, look, there was a difference. Unfortunately, the air quality in our cities is not what we'd like it to be overall anyway, but there is a difference, and the responders were exposed to things that the rest of the people in the city of Manhattan were not. And that's the good news of it.
That's going to be it. We're going to close on that in regards to having that discussion for any future callers. Any other question, David?
Last one, and then I'll sign off. Is there any place in a McCain cabinet for Christy Todd Whitman?
That would
great,
be up to the senator. He's got to win an election first.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Thanks. Bye.
That brings me right into my next topic. Christy?
Yeah, I'm here.
Governor Whitman?
Yeah. Yes,
okay.
I'm here.
Which candidate between Barack Obama and John McCain clearly has a similar policy, energy policy, similar to the Whitman Strategy Group?
Well, both of them are talking about the need for a comprehensive energy policy, and both of them are talking about including nuclear in it. John McCain has been a little more forthcoming on nuclear because Senator Obama is facing the problem that the president of the Senate, Harry Reid, who is his real leader in the Senate, comes from
right.
Nevada. Nevada is the place that has been designated by the Department of Energy to host the site for the repository for the spent
mm-hmm.
garage for the waste, and he doesn't want it there. And so no Democrat can really stand up and say, I want to move forward with nuclear, and I know what we're going to do with the waste because it's going to go to Yucca Mountain, even though the government spent all this money on it and all the tests have been done, because they can't cross Harry Reid. So he hasn't been as engaged as John McCain has on it, but they both at least are talking about these issues, and that's what's important and to me is critical, because maybe we'll get a good discussion. Maybe finally we'll get some action, and whoever's elected will feel pressure from the public to take action on this.
Well, both of them are opposed to drilling in Anwar.
I think they both are. I don't know what John McCain has said.
Yeah.
In the past, he said he's against that. You know, Anwar, it's interesting. There's probably not a lot of oil up there. There may be gas. The real challenge
right.
that they have is getting it down to the lower 48. Anwar, and they may have just decided that they weren't going to come to EPA because they didn't think they'd get much sympathy from us, but I didn't get a lot of pressure from utilities wanting to come in and talk about Anwar. It wasn't the utilities that were really pressing it that much. They have other sources that they'd like to explore. There's more in the Gulf that
right.
they'd like to explore that actually we now see the Cubans are starting to drill in the Gulf. I mean, there are other
right.
countries coming in off our shores, obviously not within our territorial waters, but in waters that where we could be drilling as well and starting to take some of these resources.
Well, the Chinese, yeah, they're drilling off the Cuban waters. Mm-hmm. That's been documented. But also the fact that Barack Obama is really focusing more on ethanol. It appears that he's more. That's one of the reasons he's opposed to drilling in the United States. Do you agree with that?
I have a real concern with that. In that, I do believe in biofuels. I think we need to do more, but we've got to be really careful because this corn-based ethanol that is part of the farm bill that has been such a
right
thing is having enormous ramifications throughout the country and the world on food.
In the world,
that we have to recognize. It's interesting. People just didn't think it through. If the corn was being used for something else and you take it now to make it into gas, what happens to where it was already going? And it was already going to feed the livestock that ends up feeding people. It was going into making the breadstuffs, the field corn, is used for flour and those sorts of things. And so when it isn't there anymore or it's costing, there are more and more people who are growing corn to have it go to ethanol, and then it's driving up the cost of what's left. And the consumer is paying the price.
That farm bill was the farm bill was horrendous.
I think it was a real problem. And I give again, this is another place where I will give the administration credit for working hard to try to get rid of some of these subsidies that are counterintuitive and counterproductive, and getting rid of some of the bailout for some of the big farms. The small farmer is not getting helped by this farm bill. It's the mega farmers that get the support and the help.
I mean, we're already seeing the impact of the cost of food throughout the world. I mean, the riots in the Middle East, in Africa, in South America. I mean, this crisis has evolved in so many different ways in so many different countries throughout the world.
You're absolutely right. You're seeing it all over the world, and it's exacerbated by this rush to biofuels based on corn. And it also has impacted by things like, look at Myanmar, where that disaster took place was in their rice paddies, in their rice bowl, where they were producing most of their rice. Now they're not going to be able to feed themselves, and Lord knows they have enough problems anyway with the flooding. But it's a serious issue, and it's a serious issue for not just this country and not just our consumers, but as you point out, around the globe. And again, I think it's a misplaced effort to have renewable fuels. There are other renewable fuels that can do a better job, and we need to keep working on them and make sure that we understand all the consequences, the unintended consequences of our actions, because they can have just enormous negative consequences, negative impacts around the world.
Governor, I was... Again, while I was researching, preparing for the program with you, I really was impressed with one of the products, the company that produces the Redzone Robotic. Can you give us, for my listening audience, to know about what this company is actually doing? Because I think it's incredible. It's fantastic.
Well, we're
the clean. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The clean water and sanitation, protecting our vital infrastructure.
Right, and this is an enormous issue for us, for this country. I mean, we're looking at a cost of anywhere between $800 billion and $1 trillion in repairing our water infrastructure. And as much as I believe that climate change is an issue and one that on which we need to take, if we take some action now, we can avoid major problems in the future. The most immediate environmental challenge that we have in this country and in the world is water, quantity and quality. Mm. And so this is a company that is breaking new ground in helping to identify where there are problems and also in finding ways to clean water and to help communities do that in an affordable manner. So it isn't this outrageous cost to the consumer because it all gets passed down. The consumer gets to pick it up at the end of the day, and we have to make sure that it happens in a way using a technology that is least expensive but does the job for us. So we are protecting people and providing clean and safe drinking water. We have a number of companies that have people who have come to us who have technologies that we look at, and if we think that A, the issue is an appropriate one, and B, the technology looks like it's a technology that really works, then we're happy to introduce them to people and to talk about them.
And the other one is the air cycle, the bulb eater.
I found those two.
That's
a great one, because we do have a problem with how do we get rid of bulbs, particularly as we move into this new generation of light bulb that lasts forever and is much more environmentally sensitive but has some products in it, i.e. mercury, that need to be dealt with in an appropriate manner. You can't just put them into landfills. And this is a company that has a product that actually takes care of a lot of that and takes out the bad stuff before it goes to the landfill. And we call it bulb eaters.
It's
not the most technical of names. But again, it's a product that we think could really make a difference in the long run.
We have another caller, but and I just basically I was looking at it seems that it should be okay. Yes, good evening. What is your name and your question for Governor Whitman?
Yes, my name is Manny Badillo, and I have a question. My uncle died on 9/11.
Manny, we the governor has answered this question already.
I'd like to ask about the air quality.
No, we the governor has answered that question. If you have another question, please do. If you don't, you can listen to my show on podcast. She has given the answer.
I'd like to ask about my uncle died on 9/11. Family members.
Okay. Manny, please. We've already covered that. You can listen to my podcast and listen to what the governor has said. All right.
Family members are for a new investigation. Governor Mitten, would you support that?
I'm sorry. Would I support what? I didn't get that.
These family members are looking for a new investigation into 9/11 based on the lies our government told us. Would you support a new investigation into 9/11?
I don't think we need a new investigation, but, I mean, people are going to investigate, and that's fine. I have nothing to hide, so I don't have a problem with it personally, if that's what you're asking. The thing that's sad about this is we keep looking at each other and saying we're responsible. You know who's responsible? You know who we ought to be going after? It's the terrorists. They're the ones
right.
who caused this problem. And they're the ones that wreak the havoc, and that's where we ought to really be focusing our attention. But I have absolutely nothing to fear or to hide. So if you want to have another investigation, I'm sure there will be others.
All right, Manny. Manny, that's we have to go on. Thank you.
Statements relating to – hello?
Thank you. Okay, Governor Whitman.
Yeah.
We have in New Jersey, we'll cover New Jersey politics. How do you see the current financial budget situation that New Jersey is facing?
Well, clearly we've got real issues. There's a deficit that the governor's been trying to deal with, and it requires tough choices. The real thing that I think is a concern is you just can't keep increasing the budget, and they're now getting that under control. The first 2 years, the average increase was 8.5%, and you just can't have that. You cannot do that when you have a budget deficit. I remember back when I first took office, my first budget was actually less in absolute dollars than the previous year's budget of Jim Florio, and the year after that, we held it to the same level, and it wasn't fun. It wasn't pleasant. A lot of people didn't like it, but that's what you've got to do if you're going to get things back under control. Now, in fairness to the governor and in fairness to the job he's got to do, only about 17% of the budget is discretionary spending. The rest is determined by formula. It's things like pensions and contracts, And a lot of contracts during the McGreevy years were let and sweetened, and ages were reduced for the time that you can actually apply for getting your pension, things like that that are going to determine costs for future years in the state, that it's going to be very difficult. And I saw there was an article the other day about how Pennsylvania is stealing jobs from us, and yeah, they're stealing jobs and they're stealing people because it's less expensive over there.
I think it boils down again to wasteful spending that needs to be reduced at every level. And until that happens, the economy in the state of New Jersey will continue to sour. Do you agree?
And there's no question about that. You have to have that kind of discipline. I mean, we were able to reduce taxes, but we also reduced spending. I believe in reducing taxes, letting people keep more of what they've earned, but you can't do that in a vacuum. You can't do that and keep spending. You've got to control the spending. And there's always a lot of waste in government. You can go after that. It's hard. It's easy to say, but it's hard to do. But you can do it. I mean, it's amazing how much government spends on things and how much it wastes, and we need to get after that. But we need to also understand that we can't keep having government pay for projects that, particularly at the federal level, that are not part of the federal government's responsibility. They may be perfectly fine projects. I mean, they may be playgrounds in a community somewhere that needs a playground, but is that the federal government's responsibility? It was like the bridge to nowhere in Alaska, and the real tragedy there is the people tried to give the money back, and the federal government said, no, you can't do that. The Congress said, no, you have to take the money. I mean, it's mind-boggling when that sort of thing happens. We need to have a much more open process. We need to have some laws, regulations, because it's not going to be a law, but that Congress has to agree that they're not going to allow riders to be, that's these extra spending bills, to be put on to a bill with which they have nothing to do. I mean, what happens is that a congressman or a senator will add a spending program to a bill like defense spending. And nobody wants to vote against defense spending. Nobody wants to vote against helping our soldiers, our men and women who are serving us and protecting us. And yet, by voting for that, they're also voting for the Bridge to Nowhere and other projects that have nothing to do with defense spending. I mean, every time at EPA, when we would send a budget up to the Hill, every year the budget came back more than what we asked for. Now, we're perfectly happy to get the money, but it wasn't for programs if we'd been able to spend the money on programs that we thought were our responsibility and were our priority, but they weren't. There were a lot of programs that just weren't our priority, and we really didn't think we should be having to undertake. It was nice to have the money, but it just the process is broken right now, and we have to see people stand up and say, we're going to take we recognize our responsibility to the American public and to future generations.
What they do is they sneak in these earmarks in these sort of types of bills at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm. And they haven't even read bills half the time. They can't. I mean, the bills come on their desks. These are huge, very complicated bills. Even their staff, in many instances, haven't had time to go through them. They don't know what they're voting on half the time. I mean, all the things in it. I don't mean to say that they don't know what they're voting on. Of course, they're responsible people, and they make their best effort. But what are you going to do if you get a budget bill of 400 or 500 pages at 11 o'clock at night, and the vote is scheduled for the next morning? You know, can't have the kind of thorough discussion, and a part of that problem is allowing people to put the riders and put the add-ons, as it were, to bills that have nothing to do with the overall content of the bill.
Great. To conclude, if you can give us an overview of what's going on with what's been happening with the Republican Leadership Council.
Well, I founded that. I didn't found that. That was an organization that had been going for some 12 years, I guess, and been sort of defunct the last few. And when I wrote my book, It's My Party Too, after I wrote that book, I started a political action committee called It's My Party. And it was to support candidates at the state and local level who are fiscal conservatives but don't feel that you have to have a litmus test for every issue under the sun and don't feel that it's a sin to work with members of the other party if you want to get something done for the public. and are willing to work with even other Republicans who may not agree with them on every issue. And that was actually quite successful for about a year, but I realized that unless you'd read my book or heard me talk, you wouldn't know about it. So we took over with Jack Danforth, who was a senator for Missouri and state attorney general, and Michael Steele, who was the lieutenant governor of Maryland, was one of the founding co-chairs of the RLC. And we are continuing to support candidates. We're in 21 states now and continuing to support candidates around the country who believe as we do, at this, particularly at the state and local level, because that's where we feel we really can make a difference.
Well, that's great. Now, how many chapters do you have throughout the United States?
Well, we have members in every state of the union, but active chapters, because they're all volunteers, in 21. And actually, we have a couple of states where they have come forward and they've hired, they've raised the money to hire professionals, to full-time people to help them run the organizations, Missouri being one of them. These are people who are just tired of the partisan bickering on both sides of the aisle. They're tired of the idea that everything has to be about the party. They say, no, what about us? We're the American people. We're the taxpayers. We're the people who elected you to represent us.
Right.
We understand party labels should give us an idea of how you will approach an issue, but I don't think any of us elect our representatives thinking that they're only going to vote for the party. We elect them to represent us and vote for us, and we've got to get back to that.
Well, Governor Whitman, it's been an honor and a pleasure to have you participate and appear on my radio show, and once again, I apologize for some of the calls.
I understand the legitimate questions, and there are a lot of concerns, and things have been taken out of context, and they've been twisted. And right now it's all seen through the prism of this administration, which has very low approval ratings and has clearly, on other instances, massaged and managed and changed some data. They did not do that on 9/11. That was an American tragedy. And I can say there was a press release where one line was changed, but that was it. The rest of the time we were putting out information that was absolutely unvarnished and in the best interest based on the best information that we had. And people have to understand it's too bad when people get this kind of a feeling that they can't trust their government, because God forbid we should ever have another tragedy like this or another crisis. There's got to be a source that you can rely on, and that should be your federal government ultimately, or your government in general.
Well, well said. And again, thank you for taking time. I know you have a very busy schedule, and do come back.
Will do.
Whenever.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Governor Whitman.
Okay.
Have a good evening.
Bye.
That was Governor Whitman. We'll be taking some questions. Yes, good evening.
Hello.
Yes, I apologize. We just had to finish on other topics that we needed to cover. What is your question?
Yes, I wanted to get through to Governor Whitman. There is a House resolution to make legal industrial hemp in the United States. I think this would address many of the environmental crises that we see as a result of a petroleum-based economy. But I have to say that I have to agree with the caller who is voicing concerns about 9/11. There are many in the first responder community who see Christine Todd Whitman as someone very responsible for many people suffering at the aftermath of 9/11. So if you could just respond to those claims, thank you very much.
Okay. I think Governor Whitman indicated that they did everything that was in their power to protect and do and cover as many things as possible in protecting all the workers. If you want to listen to what she originally said in the beginning of the show, you can always go back and listen to my podcast.
Right.
On WW Block Talk Radio, Let's Get Real with Ruben Torres. But the bottom line is this, that the real responsible people, the people who we should be upset at, are the terrorists. They're the ones who caused this.
The Environmental Protection Agency is responsible for the statement on the 18th of September that the air was safe to breathe. How many people took that advice and went down to help without the proper protection? And now how many are sick and suffering?
That was
over 50,000 of our heroes And this information, regardless of whether it was, we got to find some accountability. And many of those that are sick and suffering, dying of cancer, of the lungs and many other things, they see Whitman as fully responsible for this. And now maybe she was caught between a rock and a hard place, but many of us see her as a criminal. And the EPA as responsible for all these deaths. We need the federal government to take care of our first responders. And this is the main issue. But on to the hemp. Why is it that we won't see Republicans like Whitman get behind the House resolution to legalize industrial hemp? Hemp could be used to fuel our cars, and this is a healthy alternative to petroleum in our cars and many, many other things. So this is a crime against humanity, this illegalization since the 1930s.
Definitely, no. And I'll pass that on to Governor Whitman, and if you can send me an email, I will get an answer from her.
Okay, wearechange.org. Thank you, brother.
All right. Thank you. Have a good evening. Well, we'll be on next week. Tomorrow night, we have Will Bauer. Thank you, and have a good evening.